Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Now, you listen to the free podcast every week, so you may not care that Ring of Fire Radio is on almost 45 stations across the country. We want to stay on terrestrial radio, really, for one major reason. We want to reach more people. We want to reach people by accident. When you sing out Ring of Fire Radio podcast, you're looking for a informative, news-driven, liberal, progressive podcast, and you find it. But when you're on terrestrial radio, we're reaching people who would never hear these ideas, never hear the authors, never hear the journalists, never hear this perspective. Radio is dominated by the right wing. But the fact of the matter is, there is no money to be made in radio anymore. So we rely on our members to push this show out on 45 stations across the country, and to push out a free podcast every week. If you want to help us in that project and get two times more content than you're getting now, as well as access to all of our archives, head over to rofpodcast.com. For literally a couple of quarters a week, you can support this program and help keep us on the air. And by the air, I mean terrestrial radio. Thanks so much for your help. Next week, we'll be running a best of because we're going down to Vegas for the Mass Torts Made Perfect conference. We're going to interview a bunch of tort lawyers about some of the cases they're pursuing, some of the most important issues across the country right now. Best of next week. Thanks again for all of you who are becoming members this week. It's really important. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on the show, Pam Vogel from Media Matters will join us to report on the manipulative ads Sinclair Broadcasting is forcing local anchors to read, now airing across the country. Trita Parsi will join us to discuss two major upcoming nuclear moves involving the Iran deal and North Korea. Ari Berman from Mother Jones will explain why Donald Trump is planning to rig the census. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to break down this week's biggest news stories. And lastly, Mike Konza will join us to talk about his piece where he asked the question, why are there no good conservative critiques of Trump's unified government? Don't forget, you can go to rofpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this show. That's rofpodcast.com. Here to help me analyze the biggest news stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So Heather, this week, among other things, we saw Donald Trump basically proving to the country that he has no real idea what DACA means or refers to as he was tweeting away his anger that everybody's trying to jump on board of the DACA bandwagon, seemingly unaware that that is literally impossible. But putting that aside for a moment, the other interesting development was he started attacking Amazon. Specifically, there's a lot of reason to believe that this is very personal for Donald Trump. He doesn't like Jeff Bezos for whatever reason. And it has been a very interesting moment where, and, you know, I think in the past, maybe we've touched briefly on the idea of sort of platforming never Trumpers. This brings up like another side of that coin, too, is what happens on those few times when Donald Trump is maybe right for the wrong reasons or wrong for the right reasons or whatever it is? Like, where do you go? Because Amazon, there's a lot of issues that people on the left have with Amazon, ranging from their treatment of their workers, ranging from monopolistic behavior, ranging from having basically built their business largely on government largesse, the idea that they don't pay any federal income taxes, the idea that maybe some money is left on the table at the U.S. Post Office. Where do you come down on this, and particularly this debate about do you side with Trump if he, like a broken clock, is right twice a day?
Well, there are two ways to go about that. You know, if you're an intellectual or a person who deals, you know, is an expert in certain issues or an academic, I think, you know, you kind of have to go with what you see is the truth in these situations, right? So, you know, if you're a person who writes about monopoly and antitrust and you think that Trump, that Amazon is, you know, is abusing its power in, you know, one way or the other, yeah, I think you have to make the argument on the merits, right? I mean, otherwise you lose your credibility as someone who speaks on those issues. But for people who deal in politics, I think that there's a different responsibility here. And certainly for me personally, if I'm looking at that issue, I know what Trump is really trying to do, and this is the second time he's done it, because he also backed the Department of Justice blocking the AT&T Time Warner merger under the auspices of the antitrust laws, and which I think that most, you know, people who are concerned with this issue, mostly on the left, I mean, I've never known a right-winger to care about monopolies before, not really, at least not for 100 years. You know, this is something that you know, we would normally say, rah, rah, you know, good, they're going after antitrust, finally. But the intent matters on this. And the only two things, the two big companies that I've heard Donald Trump go after are that AT&T and Time Warner merger and Amazon, run by Jeff Bezos, who also owns the Washington Post. In other words, his intention has nothing to do with antitrust, and it's a direct attack on the First Amendment. So for me, I don't have any trouble prioritizing that that issue. I think when it comes to civil liberties, that's kind of non-negotiable and nonpartisan. I mean, I would back, you know, I would back George W. back Dick Cheney if he were, you know, in the completely impossible event that he ever stood up for civil liberties. But, you know, those are pretty fundamental. I mean, that's the kind of thing that it's always that cross-partisan thing. You know, I've been on the same side as Rand Paul, who is, you know, hardly my idea of a great politician, but we have been on the same side of certain issues, and I'm not going to go out and, you know, raise money for him or anything, but I will back his play if he's doing something in the Senate that I believe in on the civil liberties issue. You know, there's always strange bedfellows on those issues. You're always kind of cross current. So for me, that's not really a problem, particularly when Donald Trump has made a fetish of attacking the free press and has now gone out of his way to, you know, lift up a group like Sinclair Broadcasting, which is clearly a propaganda network, and basically is out there doing advertisements on his Twitter feed every day for Fox News. So to me, this is a very, very serious problem. And, you know, as far as Trump's reasoning, you know, I mean, if Amazon's a bad company, great, you know, let all the academics and everybody who cares about Amazon do their thing. But if it means that at the same time, on a political level, that we're enabling Donald Trump to whittle away at the idea of the free press, which I think is really true. I mean, you know, a lot of people say, hey, look, what can he do? He can't really do anything about this. This is just him, you know, babbling. Well, you know, no, he's the president of the United States, and he's out there attacking the First Amendment. I mean, that is just not an acceptable thing, and it has to be challenged. And so, you know, for me, this is not a difficult issue. It's an issue of civil liberties. It's an issue of prioritizing the fact that his intention is to basically try and change the structure of the way our free press operates and enable propaganda networks like Fox and Sinclair to dominate the industry. That's not something we can put up with. And, you know, I mean, hopefully there will be plenty of pushback from various quarters, although you notice the right wing isn't particularly
engaged
in this particular First Amendment issue, one way or the other.
And we're going to be talking to some folks from Media Matters about Sinclair Media later in the program. And, it's interesting because we are now, after, over a year, still in this situation where we are looking back and, a year ago, I remember upon Trump's election, I remembered at that point, wondering, how much should we be fighting against his authoritarianism and how much should we be waging politics? And it is, we are constantly walking that line.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to deify Amazon because someday, theoretically, we're going to be in a position where we should be dealing with issues like monopolies and treatment of workers. And we got to be able to chew gum and walk at the same time. But you're right. Donald Trump's agenda here has nothing to do with those. And I don't know. It just it reminds me of Thomas Friedman saying, I wanted to go to war. I had much better reasons, though. And
exactly.
That didn't work out too well. All right. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with more from Heather Parton. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, here is in the last segment, we were talking about Donald Trump going after Amazon. And while Amazon has monopolistic practices, while I think the post office could make some extra money by raising their prices for what they're doing for Amazon. And Amazon's got labor issues, et cetera, et cetera. The bottom line is Donald Trump is not our ally on this. It's one thing to write a think piece. It's another to praise Donald Trump for going after Amazon. And I should also add, it's another thing, too, to deify Amazon just because they happen to be a victim of Donald Trump's. We got to protect Amazon to the extent that we want to protect a free press when it comes to the Washington Post. Same thing with Time Warner. You made that point. But here's an issue that is completely unambiguous. It is Scott Pruitt. He is the head of the EPA. His expertise prior to being the head of the EPA was attacking the EPA, literally had, I think, over a half a dozen suits against the EPA, trying to prevent them from doing their job. He is not interested in protecting the environment. Therefore, his being head of the EPA is rather anachronistic. But now he's turning back the CAFE standards. This is just insane to me.
It's unbelievable. I mean, in fact, when he made the announcement earlier in the week, he was, I mean, this is how amazing it is that he was scheduled to make the announcement at a Chevy dealer in Virginia, and all the Chevy dealers, and it's, it was one particular one that was a big, anti-CAFE standards, anti-climate.
Climate denier, yes.
Climate denier, and it was one guy, but all the other Chevy dealers in the area, they were part of their regional network or whatever, put up a huge fight and said, no, we don't want him here. We don't want to be associated with this announcement or with the Trump administration's position on this, because we're afraid of the consumer backlash, and rightfully so. You know, I mean, and that's Chevy dealers. I mean, this isn't, you know, this isn't a bunch of, you know, hippies out in San Francisco. I mean, these guys are, they sell cars. And that's how shocking this particular announcement is. And that's on top of dozens of other regulations that he's rolling back on the Clean Water Act, on all kinds of stuff. And now it turns out, even more astonishing, is that it turns out that he is completely corrupt from top to bottom. He's involved with all these you know, polluting industries. He's taking money. He's living in a condo for practically nothing, that's owned by a person associated with major polluters. I mean, this guy is unbelievable. And that's on top of the fact that he's completely paranoid. You know, he's the guy who had to have the cone of silence, and that he's right, riding around on airplanes first class, and now they were actually looking into getting him his own private plane because he's so paranoid about having to deal with the public. He feels his personal safety is endangered. Spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on this personal travel. Frankly, I don't even understand why he has to travel so much, but for whatever reason, he does. And then it turns out this week, it was revealed that he got massive raises for people, went around the White House doing it, and has been out there talking to every, you know, been pushing himself hard to replace Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. The guy's nuts. But you know, he is, let's be honest here, he's getting the job done. I mean, he is getting the job done, and it's a big, important one to the right wing. And not necessarily Donald Trump, who I don't think knows anything about the environment or actually even cares, other than he thinks that all regulations should be, you know, should be rolled back. But all the others, the donors, the big money boys that backed, and especially in the oil and gas and energy sector that backed the Republicans, they are getting their money's worth with this guy. He is absolutely delivering for them. And I think what's amazing is, you know, the Congress is saying nothing, and everybody's just kind of standing by and watching this bizarre spectacle sort of unfold without feeling like there's nothing to be done, because Trump does not seem inclined, despite all the corruption that's been revealed, to let this guy go.
Well, you know, I mean, I think, first off, it makes sense for Donald Trump to surround himself with a bunch of corrupt people, because it makes his corruption far less, I think, stand out in the same way. He's long gone now, but I do remember a certain former advisor getting up in front of CPAC and saying, our agenda is to destroy the administrative state. And they are getting that job done at the EPA. You know, it also, though, I have to say this, and it surprises me that it has not come up more. It reminds me of the Clean Air or Clean Skies Initiative under the Bush administration. This is when they came in and lowered the federal standards on how much mercury could be put in the air by coal-fired power plants. And they did this and literally forced states to lower their standards as well, so that you didn't even have states who were able to maintain their higher standards as to how much pollutants could go in the air. And this CAFE standards we're seeing is not too dissimilar from that. There's talk at the EPA that they're going to attempt to force California to drop their mileage requirements, because, of course, car makers are going to make their cars for California, and they're not going to make a whole nother set of cars for the rest of the country. So many cars in California. But this is how determined they are to roll back any protections for the environment. And it's what Scott Pruitt does best. And like you say, they're getting the job done. Well, we've got a lot more to talk about, Digby. If you will stick with me in the next hour, we have some new developments, as we seemingly always do, but they get larger and larger in import in the Mueller investigation. We will talk about that in the next hour. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Heather Parton, or Digby, will join me, like I say, at the top of the next hour. Coming up, Mike Konza will answer the question, why are there no good conservative critiques of Trump's unified government? I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Conservatives have now had complete control over the government for 14 months. Victories have been few and far between, considering Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell have a president who will literally sign everything that crosses his desk. Here to answer why there are no good conservative critiques of Trump's unified government, Mike Konzel, a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute.
So, Mike, let's talk about 2009 like you do in your piece, just to sort of set up the premise here. I remember 2009. There was the first concerns with the Obama administration, I think, had to do with the bankruptcy bill and the cram down. And then from there, there was a lot of debate about all sorts of issues that were bubbling up. Talk a little bit about that so we set the premise here.
Yeah. I was joking on Twitter that it's kind of boring to relitigate 2016. So let's relitigate 2009 instead, which kicks up a whole other hornet's nest. And, you know, we'll talk about conservatives in a little bit, but I remember it was very intense and very argumentative and a lot to deal with at the time. But especially looking back on it, there was a real serious debate about how unified democratic governance was going. This is with the Democrats coming into office with some very clear plans on what they wanted to do that were well worked out in advance, like health care reform, immigration, cap and trade, but also stuff that had shown up very recently, like a foreclosure crisis and a really big Great Recession. And, you know, the Obama presidency was always pretty happy to take half a loaf and sometimes even less than half of a loaf. And a lot of left liberals, both in the media, like yourself, people writing in blogs, people at, you know, Daily Coast and Fire Dog Lake, and in activism space and at think tanks, intellectuals were writing and organizing, saying maybe we should be pushing harder on these things and thinking through how to do it, because there are real consequences to not doing this right, as we saw in a lot of these spaces.
And this is all sort of flooding back to me now, but there were huge debates about the public option. You were an emo prog or a firebagger at one point, or I'm not saying you, but one could be.
Mm-hmm.
There were debates about both, and we should be clear about this. There were sort of like tactical and strategic debates, but there was policy debates here that were quite vigorous and out in the open. And this is in the context of the Democrats controlling the presidency, the House, and the Senate. I think they had a veto-proof majority in the Senate for a more limited time than people remember. But nevertheless, total control. The debates were not about necessarily even how to do things or, you know, what we will do if when. It was like what was going on in that moment.
Exactly. And there was a lot of things that weren't even, I mean, a lot of people always push the 60 vote thing in the Senate, but there's a lot of things about things with the bailout funding, with foreclosure mitigation, with just investigating Wall Street, which was not a congressional issue in the sense that we're talking about needing 60 votes in the Senate. Things like putting the public option through the reconciliation bill, which claimed that now we're going very deep into some 2009 drama, 2010 drama at that point. But, you know, there was always that kind of dual debate. And I think it was really important in retrospect because it really did demarcate what people were thinking. I mean, you talked to a lot of the Obama people at the time and they were saying, well, we will all gradually go to the exchanges. So the exchanges will have to clean themselves up and we'll have to, and there'll be political push because so many people will be on the exchanges. Well, it seems like the Medicaid expansion where it went a lot better, especially the way people predicted, and the exchanges are not actually as flush in some places. They're barely there. And that should really inform our thinking going forward. I think it was a really important and interesting time where I think a lot of people who will hopefully be the next generation of leaders, people like Elizabeth Warren, who was a big TARP critic and a big critic of the bailouts, and a lot of writers and activists really kind of cut their teeth on that coming out of the Bush years. And I think it was just important in and of itself and important for developing a generation of leaders and important for really clarifying what we fight for, especially coming out of opposing Bush, which was the big thing in the mid-aughts.
Right. And, you know, as you say this, like I say, it's all coming sort of like washing back over me. But there were, I certainly felt coming out of those Bush years that I started to realize like, oh, some of these people are not necessarily on the same side as me about a bunch of issues. I mean, at one point or for an extended period of time, Obama and many sort of like, I don't know, I guess you would call them liberal lions of the media were full on advocating cuts to Medicare and to Social Security. Medicare by raising the age of eligibility, Social Security by cost of living decreases. And, you know, to contemplate that now, that's heresy in today's Democratic Party. And I think part of the reason is because we had those battles at that time. I would also add Occupy Wall Street and everything that came out of income inequality was in some ways pushing back on that stuff.
Right. I mean, I went back and reread a lot of stuff that was coming out of like your Fire Dog Lakes and The Nation. And there was a very big sense. And then it still shows up nowadays. But at the time, in late 2010, early 2011, which is what kind of sets into Occupy in that wave, a real sense of missed opportunity. The word disappointment comes up a lot in President Obama's first 2 years. Now, because of our current president, I think there's a lot of nostalgia for having a very competent and impressive president. But at the time, coming out, there was a huge sense like we blew it and we missed a lot of stuff.
Well, and I think, you know, I think even that nostalgia gets at one of the sort of the contrast between that era and this era now, one in terms of what was happening on the broad, you know, center to the left, and one that's happening from the center to the right now, because you contrast Obama's administration with Trump's by talking about Obama the person. He was a very impressive human being, and we can't say the same thing about the president now. And in some respects, that exemplifies the difference between what we're seeing in terms of the inter-party, I guess you could call it, debate that we're seeing now. I mean, so tell us about what your observation is about what's happening on the right relative to that era of the Obama administration.
You know, you occasionally see those debates about Obama flare up, and they're flaring up again right now in foreign policy, which is just a different world than me, but than what I study. But people, now that Trump is appointing people who are very involved with Bush's torture regime to senior positions, you know, Obama's decision not to investigate seems a lot worse. And it came up, so I keep seeing these things, and now there's also this parallel debate, and this is the thing my piece focuses on, is we're talking a lot about conservative intellectuals and conservative writers, and writing's kind of a navel-gazy thing, so everyone's writing about Kevin Williamson or the New York Times op-ed page. And I just sit back and I think, what are these people even talking about? What are conservatives who are paid to write and think and organize in the public sphere doing, because all I see is them complaining about teenagers, like college campus kids don't respect free speech. These teenagers don't even know anything about guns, which whatever you make of those arguments, and I disagree with them on that, conservatives run the government. You would never know that reading them. You would never know that they have unified control of the government. They have an agenda that is very amicable to going through reconciliation. So they only need 50 votes in the Senate. And they came in with this idea that they are very smart and they have good policy ideas and they can reform healthcare and change the nature of the social safety net in a way that's pro-growth and pro-conservative values. And they've largely that all up, and they've done nothing with that. And the only thing that they've really accomplished is deregulation and cutting taxes for rich people, which is stuff we knew that they could do anyway. So I see no self-reflection or no debate in their space, and I really wonder what the consequences are of that.
All right, well, let's take a break, and when we come back, let's talk about what the consequences of that could be. And also, you know, why is that the case? I mean, it is sort of shocking. I remember when Donald Trump was president-elect, reading all sorts of stories about how Paul Ryan had been sitting out there and they had all the plans to go and they had done all the thinking about this. And yes, they cut taxes, but I feel like my 12-year-old daughter could have told you that would have been the least unimaginative thing for them to do. When we come back, we'll talk more about what has happened to the supposed thinkers on the right. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Back. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking with Mike Konzel about his piece in Medium, Why Are There No Good Conservative Critiques of Trump's Unified Government? So, Mike, when we broke, we were talking about what was happening on the broad left in the Democratic Party in the year 2009 and 2010, when Barack Obama, when the Democrats had more or less unified control of the government, when Barack Obama was starting his policies. And there was a lot of debate. There was a lot of debate about what policies should work. There was a lot of debate as to whether or not Obama had the administration had done the right moves. There was a lot of debate about a whole host of things. And you've written a piece talking about the sort of marked lack of that on the right now. I mean, we have never Trumpers, as you say, but from a policy standpoint, Is it that there's total agreement, or is it that nobody seems to care?
So, you know, I was wondering if I was missing a point here, but I've had a lot of conservatives write me and say that I was on the right point here. And the quick scratch test for your audience is, think of how many conservatives just complain about teenagers instead of really debate. You watching Fox News, this is a comment Chris Hayes and others have pointed out, watching Fox News, you would never know that Republicans control the entire federal government. And they control in a pretty disciplined way, and they have plans that they want to do. Because all they do is complain about how they're powerless and no one listens to them and the teenagers don't respect them. And you would never know that there was real conservative governance going on. Among a lot of conservative writers, there's this Never Trump impulse, which talks a lot about what kind of a mess Donald Trump is, and that's a totally fair and accurate point. But that cuts both ways, because the fact that he is just obsessed with fighting about Twitter means that the congressional Republicans could pass whatever they want. And so things like health care repeal, which, you know, they spent 8 years talking about how they had a better plan for health care. The fact that it imploded the way it did, and the fact that no one's talking about or doing retrospectives or saying, what could we have learned or what could we have done different, either in a journalistic kind of way or in a more policy think tank wonky kind of way, the fact that you have none of that conversation is very telling. I think, and at this point, I wonder if it's really showing that something's broken in the conservative movement outside of just serving the interests of rich people.
Yeah, I mean, and is there something broken in the conservative movement, or is this basically just what happens when The emperor shows up and people are asking, where are the clothes? I mean, you know, is this something new in the conservative movement, or are they incapable when they're governing? I mean, you know, people have been writing about why, how ridiculous it is that, like, the New York Times, for instance, you know, puts David Brooks on the opinion page as if he's expressing, you know, the conservative viewpoint. But I mean, I think you're making the point here that the conservative viewpoint is there is none except for cultural grievance. Now is the time where we should be seeing them implement policies or complain that policies aren't implemented. And there seems to be none of it.
Yeah, there's no, with the exception of a few Ross Duthout columns, I see virtually nothing really trying to examine why did their health care bill fail? I mean, this was the central debate of the last 8 years, and it'll be a very central debate going forward. You know, they came in saying that I bought the hype that they were going to pass something in January. In fact, deep political nerds might know that there was debate about Congress showing up early in January of 2017 to pass a repeal bill that Donald Trump could sign on his first day. That's how central it was, and that's how much they believed that they were going to be able to accomplish something. And I think there's a couple things. One, and I think this is likely what's going to happen, is that they're going to blame Donald Trump for the fact that their policies are unworkable, unpopular, cruel, and not well thought out. It's actually kind of a blessing for them when, you know, instead of saying, oh, we tried to take away health care from tens of millions of vulnerable people, which is a kind of evil thing to do and also just a very unpopular and not, you know, able to be done very easily kind of way. They'll say, oh, well, Donald Trump was a mess. Look at how much oxygen he took up. Look at what a messy tweeter is, and he's picking up all these fights. When in reality, he would have signed anything that got to his desk, which is kind of what the congressional Republicans really wanted all along. Another thing is, I think they don't care about specifics. The things that they really cared, when they really got in the nitty gritty, it's like, how do we exempt corporations from taxes in a much more holistic way? I do a lot of work on financial reform, and the bank dereg bill that just passed the Senate with the help of, unfortunately, a lot of moderate Democrats. That was really detailed policy, but it was clearly written by lobbyists. And I'm not saying that even in a mean way. It's like obviously written by lobbyists and not by like their brilliant policy wonks. So I feel in some sense that the party is really a collection of rich interests, corporate interests, and cultural grievances. And in that, if those are the things that really move policy and really move the right, liberals are wasting their time reading a lot of these conservative pundit intellectuals because they're talking in a vacuum.
All right. So, I mean, and so is this, I mean, should we be grateful, Mike? I mean, or should we be lamenting the fact that for the right, all there is paying off some of their patrons and then complaining about, you know, black athletes and high school students. And I mean, I feel like you could take away everyone's computer on the right and they wouldn't know the difference if these high school students from Parkland didn't exist. It seems to be the only thing that America is dealing with is these high school students who are upset about the fact that they're victims of mass shootings.
Yeah, I want to make it clear, I am not one of those people who's like, I wish the conservatives would get their game together so we could have a real debate, because the conservative agenda is awful and gross and mean and hurts people and benefits people who don't need it. So, like, I'm super glad they're disorganized. And in one sense, one reason I wrote this, since on Medium, is I really wanted to twist the knife and just be like, you guys have an agenda that is awful and you couldn't even do it. And why were you such failures? And the fact that you can't even find anything interesting to say about your failures. You know, when the public option failed to pass, people were talking about that in 2010. They still talk about it now.
Yes.
Will people talk about the failure of skinny repeal to pass in the same way we talked about the public option? You know, Joe Lieberman, even very moderate Dems will not talk about Joe Lieberman because he killed a Medicare buy-in. Do conservatives hate John McCain because he killed skinny repeal? I don't even think they care. I don't even think they think about it that way. And I think that's very important. And the other part of it is that there's a lot of tendency to cover this is a war of ideas, and there's a, like, the New York Times will run all these profiles about the all the brilliant young thinkers on the right, and this comes up all the time. And I think it's worthwhile to really hold them to account and say, okay, if these guys are so brilliant, make them be brilliant about what's going on right now. And if they fundamentally can't because they don't care, or the infrastructure isn't built to do anything other than grievance waving, then we should really think that, no, this is the party of capital and deregulation and grievance, and we should understand that we are engaging with that kind of with action.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Mike. I mean, we see profiles recently of Ben Shapiro, the philosopher king of the right, and all he's talking about is how he thinks that these high school students lack performative skills. All right, well, Mike,
if that was to take 1 minute away from attacking trans people to just say, like, do you guys have any ideas about how to fix healthcare? That would be a real interesting thing, but there's a reason they won't, because they can't.
Mike Konzel, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Mike Konzel is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He blogs at Rorty Bomb and New Deal 2.0. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, ROFpodcast.com to support the show.